Good morning, planet Earth. Good morning to those Hufflin types wandering the streets of New York City. Good morning to the Screebans who scour the swamp turtle forested areas of Washington, D.C. Good morning to the Scarab priests who live in the desert. They teach of nothing. They bring you nothing. Good morning to all those creatures slinking about looking for a meal. It is June the 5th, 2023, Bo Blimp Doc. It's about 2:44 a.m. here in Scompton, Utah. That's early. That's really early. Yeah. And, you know, it was one of those days where it was hot enough outside at certain times that I found myself sequestered in my basement room, huddling away from the temperature and the heat of the sun burning my skin, running in fear from that glowing orb that mocks our mortality. But it is Monday. I'm about to read something, more or less, to interpret some information through a podcast. It's something I put on my blog a few days ago. It is filed under the Lords of Bo Blimp Doc, which is, in my opinion, implicitly fictional, meaning fiction, meaning not true. So what I'm about to read you, and perhaps this will be the only topic of the podcast, is fiction. It's a story. There's a link to a PDF at the very top of the story in the notes, a link to something called The Report from Iron Mountain, and it's something I read in high school. I don't think I read the whole thing. I read parts of it. And it's one of these things that was produced in the 1960s, ostensibly representative of secret meetings of secret committees talking about how, you know, humans are douchebags and the only thing that keeps them in line is war. So we got to have some wars. If we don't have wars, people will lose jobs. Society will collapse. So let's have some more wars. I oversimplify, but the report from Iron Mountain, which, looking back, I'm told, is 100% fiction, made up, but kind of based in the way the kids use the word based these days. In the sense that you could imagine a RAND Corporation meeting in the 1960s where some guy says, well, if we don't build weapons, people will lose their jobs, and then they'll take sticks and, you know, sharpen them and turn them into weapons. So we have to build weapons unless we want people to have weapons. I mean, I'm mocking it and I'm making it sound dumber than it was, but it is really that simple, that the military-industrial complex must exist. And that's not the whole story of the report from Iron Mountain, but it's a big part of it. What I'm about to read you isn't as lofty as the report from Iron Mountain. What I'm about to read you is a fictional account of the past and a brief fictional discussion of the future. And if a lot of what I'm about to read you sort of connects with things I've talked about in the past, well, that's not accidental. You could say what I'm describing to you is a bugbear that entered my consciousness in 2018 when I was living in Seattle. And as a 48-year-old dude, 48 years on planet Boblimpdoc, I remember growing up in the Puget Sound. And I gotta say, by the year 2018, it wasn't the Puget Sound I remember. But the most interesting thing about the summer of 2018, other than that Frontier mechanic or Frontier Airlines mechanic going a little bit cray-cray and flying that plane all over Boblimpdoc, the other thing that happened in the summer of 2018 of interest in Seattle is that for about 6 weeks, it was really hard to breathe. And again, you can say, well, Dan, there have been fire seasons when I grew up. My dad was a logger. I am well aware of fire season. Never in my life in Washington State would I say for any period of time, unless you were actually in the fire itself, would it be hard to breathe. And it was simply hard to breathe at the time. And I wasn't the only person who experienced this. And people kind of pushed it off, like, that's no big deal, and it's transitional, and it's climate change. People love to say climate change. The problem is, you know, like that Dr. Freckles quote, you know that famous Dr. Freckles quote, if the government tells you something is going to happen in 100 years, you know one of two things is true. A, it'll never happen, or B, it's already happening. So that's my view on climate change and global warming and Al Gore and little Greta Thunberg. I think it's a lot of bullshit. The thing that hit me like a freight train in the summer of 2018 was this idea that all sides of the political spectrum, when it came to the environment, were lying to each other, lying to themselves, and lying to the people that they're supposed to represent. This includes the government agencies like NOAA and the National Weather Service. This includes definitely the entire military-industrial complex. This includes all these professors that we're supposed to look up to, that they were, on some level, either deceiving themselves and in turn deceiving others, or simply outright lying. Because I gotta tell you, whether it's Chevron or Professor Hansen from the UW, I don't know if I can believe anything they say. If somebody from the oil companies tells me we can go ahead and burn every barrel of oil there is without consequence, I certainly know that's bullshit. And if somebody tells me that the climate change impacts to our world are going to happen in 100 years, I definitely know that's bullshit. Because I've been alive since the year 1970. And a lot of the crap they said would happen 100 years from now, how can I put this? Look around, look up at the sky. A lot of it's already happening. And yeah, I don't know the truth about the polar bears. The fact is, when it comes to the permafrost and the Arctic, it almost seems like there's a kind of weird news blackout. Like when you research the topic, you get articles from 2 or 3 years ago. Nothing very current. And what they'll tell you is, well, damn, there's a war going on. Well, isn't that fucking convenient? If you wanted to block off, as I've said in many podcasts, 60% of the landmass that is the permafrost in the Arctic Circle, nothing works better than a little war in the Ukraine. Oh, we can't go to Russia this year. We can't visit the Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf because there's a war in the Ukraine. So what I'm about to read you represents my bugbear. You might have a bugbear. I learned about a lot of people's bugbears in 2020 when it came to the COVID-19. I learned about their little fear monkeys, the little demons they keep in the closet. I learned to what extent they would use their own fear as human beings to harm their neighbor. And they would stake a claim on, well, the government told me to do this. The government told me to put on a coffee filter. The government told me to put on 3 coffee filters. The government said, don't question the commies marching up and down 12th Avenue, even though it bisected every path to every major emergency room in the summer of 2020 in Seattle, Boblimpdoc. Don't question it. Put on your coffee filter. But remember, when you sit down at the restaurant, you can take it off. Yeah. I learned about a lot of people's bugbears in 2020 and 2021. And so if you have to listen to mine, fine. You might be one of these, well, there was a lab, Dan, or there was a wet market. There was some kind of crazy bat, and he had sex with a monkey pig. And that resulted in the monkey herpes, which everybody called the COVID-19. And it was real, Dan, and it almost killed the world. It killed the flu. It killed hospital-acquired infection, which is a horror story, and was killing, like, I don't know, 200,000 Americans every year in every American hospital. Preventable hospital-acquired infection. You take that, you take the flu, you have every number of the COVID accounted for. So yeah, it definitely killed the flu. That's going to come up in some discovery and some lawsuits next year. And it definitely killed hospital-acquired infection. That'll come up in some lawsuits if next year is next year, if it's as advertised. Like, people give a shit about lawsuits next year. I don't know. So I'm going to talk about a bugbear, a fear monkey. I can't prove any of this. This is why this is fiction. This is an interpretation of many sources of data. Sources coming from, like, Professor Shakova at the University of Alaska. Dane Wigington deserves some credit for a lot of this and the stuff he's talked about. And again, I beat up on him. Maybe it's part of my paranoia. I don't know. I don't know if he's legit. But I do know that it seems like a lot of what he says has the ring of truth, and a lot of what he says is not being discussed. So this is my fear monkey. This is a story, and it's a story about land, really, special land. The Trans-Antarctic Mountains bisect a third of the Antarctic continent, cutting across Antarctica almost as if a sword through the chest of some lost and doomed Norse god. McMurdo Station, which is an American-run station, or at least used to be, McMurdo Station represents one of the entry points to this alpine chain. But let's back up. Let's wait a minute here. The Antarctic Treaty was signed in Washington, D.C. in 1959, Bo Blimp Doc, the height of the Cold War. 12 nations signed: Argentina, Australia, Belgium, Chile, France, Japan, New Zealand, Norway, South Africa. Yeah, that's apartheid South Africa. United Kingdom, United States, and the USSR. That's the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. That's the commies. 1959 was the height of the Cold War, and we're signing a treaty, taking an entire continent kind of off the map for most normal people, and we're signing it with the commies. Meditate. You see, in 1945, at the end of World War II, the Allied forces, working with a then-still allied USSR, began a weather study project. The project was called Cassandra. The purpose of the project was to determine the current state of the Earth's geoclimatic systems. The weather, the ocean currents, the various places where there seemed to be permanent ice and snow. And there's a special emphasis in Cassandra on the impacts of the Arctic and the Antarctic regions on these climate phenomena. By 1955, Cassandra came to some interesting conclusions, all of which was classified top secret, Q clearance. Number one, that the Arctic Ocean and the permafrost system served an essential role in maintaining the Earth's temperature, even driving great oceanic pumps that would allow heat exchange. Number two, the Arctic system was in the initial stages of failure. From the perspective of humans who have lived in a unique climate nexus for nearly 10,000 years, barring periodic shifts, it has mostly been stable and cooler, you know, opportune for civilization and growing cheeseburgers. But now that balance has changed and the system is breaking down. Number three, that under the Arctic Ocean in a frozen and currently stable state, there was approximately 3.4 trillion tons of methane. Within the Arctic permafrost system, there was an additional 2 trillion tons of methane after microbial life begins the process of converting formerly frozen permafrost, and nearly 100 billion tons of nitrous oxide. 100 gigatons of nitrous oxide, which, as a greenhouse gases go, is 1,600 times more potent than CO2. And all of this gets released once the process of permafrost conversion begins, meaning once the permafrost ain't, which means permanently frozen, all the little critters start eating all that, well, let's call it poop, and start converting the organics and poop and dead bodies into things like, you know, CO2, methane, nitrous oxide. And it's not a linear process. The rate, number four, of permafrost failure will be slow at first, and then accelerate through the building of multiple positive feedback loops. Every release of methane would increase the likelihood of another release of methane. And eventually, the methane systems around the world would become unstable enough along the continental shelves that even coastal methane would be released. The whole process, number five, will result in a new equilibrium climate for the planet, warmer. Many regions will become uninhabitable because of heat and humidity. Ocean levels could go up approximately 50 to 100 meters, with an end to what we would call permanent ice. We'll never see that again in multiple lifetimes. Number six, the final stage would result in rapid warming worldwide. And though the event itself might only last a decade or two, the transition period might be so cataclysmic that very few, if any, humans would survive. Number seven, that the use of geoengineering technology might slow the process. The process itself, best case, would be in final stages approximately 7 decades in the future. But it was a range prediction based on what computers were capable of in that day and age. Sometime between 2010 and 2030 was the high likelihood window. That's what their model said. Number eight, finally, this was always going to happen. This was always a thing. Like a French farmer who hits something from World War I, his plow explodes, the French farmer explodes, someone was going to trigger that unexploded bomb. I mean, is it possible that humans created a tipping point? Sure. And other creatures could have done the same thing. And a number of choices and frankly, branching possibilities within nature could have triggered the same thing. But once the process is triggered, it is relentless. It is going to happen. Project Cassandra's report, as stated, was classified Q clearance top secret. Only the leaders of certain nations and vetted advisors were allowed copies. A second project, Project NOAA, was kicked off to determine if there was anywhere on Earth where some portion of humanity might survive the coming cataclysms. Some of the scientific team from Project Cassandra were also Project NOAA analysts, and they already knew the answer: Antarctica. Antarctica. Because of the tilt of the Earth and the Earth's orbit around the Sun, Antarctica is nearly in a permanent frozen state, although the humidity might match that of a desert. The temperatures are almost always at or below freezing year-round. Even in a worst-case scenario, the Trans-Antarctic mountain chain would have areas above oceanic sea level rise, and capable of housing large bunker projects, landing strips, and even nuclear power plants. Admiral Byrd, in many of his expeditions, discovered large uranium, easily accessible uranium deposits in the Trans-Antarctic mountain chain. And, you know, these were discovered approximately 200 miles from McMurdo Station. So the recommendation was to build the complex close enough to this deposit that they could use electricity from the bunker complex to power equipment, trains, and other resources needed to mine and refine uranium. The reactors would be built near the deposits with transmission lines above ground from the power generation facilities to the bunker complexes. Despite generally arid conditions, there was a great deal of underground water in Antarctica, ready for human consumption. With hydroponics and artificial light, much of their food could be grown, and they could use green areas to assist in cleaning the air of these bunkers. The expectation would be a need to house between 10 and 20 million people. In 1955, this number would have been a significant portion of the U.S. population. In 2023, this represents a megacity. Project NOAA began to implement items from the overall plan in 1956, with the following sub-goals to be achieved by 1960. Number one, that a worldwide treaty restricting access to Antarctica under the guise of peaceful research be signed. Number two, a military psychological warfare operation to direct blame regarding any climatic impacts at consumers, car drivers, people that eat meat, just about everyone. Make humans feel guilty about the modern life they live and blame them for the disasters. Number three, begin a crash geoengineering program to manage solar radiation and to enhance chemicalized nucleation to support the Arctic and Antarctic and increase the longevity of the ice pack in the Arctic Sea. Number four, direct a campaign to downplay and ridicule topics relating to geoengineering, methane, or permafrost. It became obvious to the managing projects regarding the use of geoengineering, that there would inevitably, especially in the last few decades of such a program, be toxic effects. At a certain level of concentration, the toxicity might be immediate in many cases, resembling illness and death from respiratory diseases or infections. It might become necessary to manage the impacts of geoengineering by implementing a PSYOP program, amping up the fear of viruses and bacteria and other little critters. Support creative people in writing stories about epidemics and viral outbreaks. Michael Crichton. This way, towards the end, toxic shock and exposure to geoengineering compounds can be managed as some kind of pandemic. Another thing they realized was this. They would need to regulate economic activity in the world and local economies to enable periodic testing of atmospheric conditions. They did not believe the human component was directly contributing beyond possibly triggering the event. They did believe the human contributions impacted calculations about when the final stage of permafrost collapse would be reached, and when the first blue ocean event, that means an Arctic empty of any ice, would be seen. When the eastern Siberian Arctic shelf and other regions would be belching up destabilized frozen methane. So they figured every 5 to 10 years they would have some type of recession or economic calamity, or some other calamity that would allow them to recalibrate their model and have a more precise idea of the time frame of these events. Project NOAA began building the main bunker complex chain in Antarctica in the Transantarctic Mountains just south of McMurdo Station in 1961. At first, it was hard to get materials needed to Antarctica to conduct operations year-round in impossible conditions. Digging out and hauling out rock and debris from the bunker construction went well. Developing the logistical models around the nuclear reactors and electrification took a lot of work. And adjustment for extreme conditions that might get even more extreme in the future. It was decided that over the ground power transmission and communications linkages were preferable to buried, given the rapidly changing nature of the geography in the expected catastrophe scenario. Because there would be a great deal of transitory instability around the time that the complexes are filled and prepared, they decided to create a modular and nested hardened model for each subcomplex. Each module would be a high-integrity reinforced area inside the mountain with its own access to the main air and water resources, with its own access to the surface. Each module zone, housing approximately 10,000 people, would have all the equipment necessary for repairs and for exiting the complex in the event of adverse external conditions, persistent high temperature and high humidity conditions, extreme cold, potentially low oxygen for a while. Each module would generate and manage its own oxygen air. As such, they would be capable of operating sealed off from the outside for up to 50 years, longer possibly. The U.S. government and other participatory governments began tracking key individuals in 1965. They looked to high IQ, socially functioning individuals in many disciplines and areas as potential enlistees to the safe zone. Scientists, doctors, sex workers, entertainers, managers of industry, and engineers. Up until 2015, the list was still open. By 2015, they figured they were reliably in the 10-year window, and they had, 20 million spots, but 60 million people on the wait list alone. It was recommended that high-profile enlistees into the NOAA project fake their deaths. Helicopter crashes, planes crashing, ships sinking, drug overdoses, suicides. By faking their deaths, their disappearance from the public life would be mostly ignored by the majority, leaving only a minority of conspiracy theorists actively looking into these scenarios. The 9/11 attacks were set up to create a super window for baselining the state of the Arctic system. It provided an economic slowdown and a shutdown of air traffic for a couple weeks. This allowed all particulate matter, to include geoengineering particulates, to fall out of the air column, and this provided a better view of the state of the atmospheric and Arctic cooling system. By 2003, it was determined that the final stages of Arctic collapse would begin in the window of 2018 through 2022. A final super check of the state of things was done in 2009. A massive global economic crisis was triggered and an extreme shutdown in industrial activity, allowing for another look at the numbers, the metrics, and to update a decades-old but still used modified computer model. The model verified the 2003 conclusions and determined at 100% probability window for the worst of the catastrophe between the years 2019 and 2025. That was the likelihood window. Project Alpine, the coordinated use of geoengineering to manage and slow the rate of Arctic and permafrost collapse, began in earnest in 1959. There was a secret treaty signed by the same signatories of the Antarctic Treaty, and the secret treaty described how aircraft and other technology, to include weather tracking and model development, would be used to manipulate the Earth's climate. Since the main focus for much of this time period would be the Arctic system, It was believed it would be unnecessary to expend many resources managing public perception at first. Post-1990s, they would need to begin geoengineering at a large scale over populated areas, and at this point, some kind of cover story or military psychological warfare program would be needed to manage public perception. Yeah. I'm going to drink a little coffee here. Project Alpine would run the disinformation subprojects geared towards discrediting critics of geoengineering and anyone raising an alarm related to methane or permafrost degradation. They would control access to graduate programs in related fields of study and actively manage researchers using carrots and sticks to keep the right perspective out there regarding the climate. Once active geoengineering began over populated areas, they would need to change the story from global warming to climate change. Final stage geoengineering, to begin as predicted in the year 2015, would be highly toxic. So toxic that many people suffering from autoimmune and allergic disorders would have immediate reactions, and in significant numbers of cases, 5% of the population estimated, would simply drop dead from respiratory failure. At this point, a concerted effort would need to be made promoting new diseases, bird flus, severe or acute respiratory disorders. Because the geoengineering program would degrade the ozone layer, which protects the Earth's biosphere from UVC and much of UVB, there would need to be a program managing people's views of sunlight to include development of more powerful sunscreens. The alarm was raised secretly among the world powers in 2018. This also coincided with a Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation program promoting the fear of some new virus they called Disease X. It was decided that a multi-layered, high-intensity military psychological warfare program would be kicked off in late 2019, with some exercise known of publicly, a kind of fun game on a tabletop, like it's Dungeons and Dragons, to feed all the limited hangouts of the coming PSYOP. The kind of psychological warfare being used to manage this period of alarm would be geared towards the following compound goal. Keep people at home mainly. Keep the roads clear. Keep people divided and in a state of fear. Impact intuitive types by carpet bombing their unconscious with pseudo-disasters and lesser catastrophes. Keep people traumatized. Mainly, they needed to keep people under control so that it would be too late for them to impede Project Noah by the time they figured out what was going on. They understood from Nazi experiments that the mainly trauma-based mind control at a population scale would trigger adrenal fatigue and other chronic illnesses would be made worse. Trauma-based mind control at this scale would cause plagues of madness and insanity. The longer these operations lasted, the more severe the damage to civic society, and it was expected all the programs would lose their respective power after 5 years. The principal operation within the PSYOPs was called Project King. It would focus on a cold or flu virus that originates in China. The backstory of labs and wet markets would be maintained to keep people in one limited hangout or another if they asked too many questions. Secondary to this was Project Schism, a multi-layered program to keep people in divided subgroups, making it much easier to control the whole population. NGOs and various groups would be used to foment street violence and race and sexuality divisions, and wealth and other points of division would be accentuated and focused on by the media. Project Schism was seen as a Hail Mary if people started to ask questions about Project King. Project Wall was the project to limit access to the Arctic Circle during the final stage of Arctic system collapse. The core of this program would be a limited and localized war between Russia and one of its neighbors, ideally a U.S. ally. This would allow the shutdown of 60% of the Arctic system in order to block independent researchers. The rest of the Arctic Circle would be policed by NATO and UN forces, and that would enable an information cordon around the entire Arctic itself. Based on monitoring, it was clear members of the uniformed services of several allied nations were likely to mutiny at some point near the end. Another side mission of Project Wall was to use up as much small arms, anti-tank, anti-aircraft, and other munitions from the arsenals of these nations to include the United States. The net result would be a stealth disarmament of the conventional military of these populations, accepting the private ownership of small arms. When the green light was given in 2019, many people in positions of power resigned their jobs, left their occupations. Some of these were normal retirement events. Some involved, you know, helicopters going down. Project NOAA expected to have 100% of all enlistees in the bunker complex by January 2023. Project Dark Winter would be the final stage of geoengineering before the evacuation of enlistees is complete. This would involve massive solar radiation management, the use of magnetic field generators to distort the Earth's ionosphere, and thereby create atmospheric gyres to direct the jet stream and to circulate what was left of the cold Arctic air. The program would be so toxic that the population would need to be in a state of confusion to not become suspect. Project King would use disinformation around newer, scarier respiratory illnesses and their magical cures to manage this wave of deaths in terms of public perception. By 2024, most of the world economy is in shambles. The rapid transition effects of the Arctic collapse have become obvious even to the most blind. The NOAA complex is fully operational and fully occupied, with some accommodation on an emergency basis for waiting list people. By the year 2026, most of the world's boiling water reactors, nuclear reactors, despite being scrammed, are in a state of meltdown, polluting the coastal waters and estuaries. The simple reality is, boiling water reactors use heat exchange. Even in a scram state with control rods fully inserted, you still need to circulate cold water. And on planet Boblimpdok, for many of these locations, both the temperature and the water level was changing rapidly. This was bad. So these boiling water reactors worldwide, hundreds of them, begin to spontaneously melt down. China, Russia, and the USA and NATO decide to trigger a massive nuclear war in the futile attempt at triggering a cooling event like nuclear winter. They even decided to set off a few 20-megaton bombs near some worldwide supervolcanoes again for the stated reason to trigger some kind of ice age. By 2028, it was clear that none of this would work, and what was left of the human population was now dying of radiation illness. The NOAA complex was safe from the radiation. The amounts that reached the Antarctic were manageable by the system's closed-loop air generation and filtration. In 2029, various Gumptic tribes of North America, to include the swamp people of Oregon and Washington states, joined forces as a true revenge army whose purpose was to find those responsible and seek total revenge. Many totalistic revenge armies were on the march in 2033, Boblimpdok. All the scum classes of Sector 55 Gamma were sending their young men and women, covered in tumors and scars, to take on the automated defense fortress of Tierra del Fuego, wrongly believing this was the sweet spot for a complete escape from the poison zones in the north. All these forces were annihilated. Meanwhile, in Antarctica, the Scraggin folk of Pod 11 were in uproar. The meat paste was being rationed for some reason, and the scare monkey cadre were spreading rumors of a reprocessor breakdown. Antarctica had seen scares like this before. The great toilet paper shortage of 2030 was bad enough. All Pod 11 must die was the rallying cry of Jens Storg of Pod 3. He led the North Side coalition of nomads and other pastry chefs. In the 2040s, most of the youth of Antarctica Safe Zone were in gutter jazz and jizz pancakes. They lived off a funge minstrel and a new compound mixture from the farms where the old people were being taken more and more often. They'd have some old Uncle Dan or Aunt Frederica they'd take down to the compliance station. At that point, the old people were getting loaded onto trucks and just taken someplace. It's what people would say. My ma, she's just going someplace. In the 2070s, the first revolt of the Skloggjergen breeders began. They had been the primary sources of taco meat for a while, and they grew tired of their boobulas being used to create more. Why can't the jizz masters increase their production of clam chowder? Cried those blood harlots. A furious battle happened along the main fronts from Pod 33 to Pod 90. The cream sectors were denied access to the main food cauldron. The Outer World, as it was called in the Antarctic Safe Zone, had fallen into a weird mixture of Mad Max and Miami Vice. Various clan leaders sold a mutant strain of the coca plant extract called super cocaine. It treated radiation, it treated your tumors, it treated you real good, and got you damn straight mega high. Queen Lustra had set up her home near Vegas, but Duke Stardom was already ruling the mangy folks of former California. They were dust eaters and dirt breeders and wicked weasels living on nothing but pain. And juicing was real big then and now in this future. People were big into their juicers. The hospitals of the Antarctic Safe Zone are scrumbly pits for jail-style nurses. The food they eat in Antarctica is mostly Dindu's morgue and triple-style pork paste, some weasel mold. The sex you have in the Antarctic Safe Zone is awful and degrading and disappointing. In Antarctic Safe Zone, they sit at tables at night and gnaw on Stig bars, and they use their two good teeth to eat those Stig bars, and a few tears roll down their faces, and they stare intently into the darkness towards some calm place beyond the seas. Betel Moss Pizza is on sale most nights in an Antarctic Safe Zone, but it is made of crickets and mites. Your turntable mistress has a new position ready. Just need more of the whale grease from Teddy's. Everybody has a juicer. Everybody in Antarctica uses their juicer. Everyone knows what's in the juice. They know the darkness of the juice. They drink the juice in Antarctic Safe Zone. By the year 2100, the people of Antarctic Safe Zone are just mere facsimiles of humanity. By the year 2200, they are the Scruzzlies. They are the Skreegles. They wander blind through caverns, scraping the walls for some type of weird mutant or some type of mold that they can stick on their tongue and pretend they're alive. By the year 2300, the few humans left in Antarctica have become mungle beasts, and they live off a globe, and they wander the sand dunes looking for love, and there's nothing for them but the infinite loneliness. Do you want to go to the Antarctic safe zone? Or do you want the super cocaine? As stated, this is fiction. I would hope the way it ended would you know, kind of signal that this is fiction, this isn't true. This is a combination of research that I did since 2018 on a topic that concerned me. This is a generalized theory of why they've been doing the bullshit they've been doing. And sometime in the year 2024 or 2025, I feel comfortable throwing this entire thing away and just keeping it within the scheme of fiction. But that's why it's in the scheme of fiction. I'm not going to threaten or scare people over something I can't prove. I have suspicions. I can't prove this. So unlike the monkey pox, monkey herpes, mad people of 2020, I'm not going to scare people on the streets and say, you better put on your fucking monkey mask, your coffee filter, you better do what they say. We're all playing Simon Says. We're doing the hokey pokey. They tell you to turn around. They put arrows on the ground. I mean, I might have a bugbear, but at least I'm not going to toss it like an existential hand grenade in everybody's face. And the good news is you could have stopped listening at any time. Okay? This is fiction. I hope it's fiction. I hope that it's mostly just bullshit. I gave you the link to the report from Iron Mountain because it's a more substantial kind of thing that is also probably fiction, but based. I don't know that what I just described is based or not. If you enjoy my podcast, you can donate to it. There's a PayPal link in the notes. On Spotify until they kick me off. I can't post anything to YouTube right now because I've got a strike against my account. And my intuition tells me that they're probably going to kick me off the platform pretty soon. It's okay if you want to post pictures of your doggy or absurdly abstract things that nobody can understand. But if you actually want to talk about the truth in some form, or be authentic in some form, YouTube can't really allow that. They can allow the synthetic ChatGPT style existence, the superficial nonsense, but if you actually go deeper, like with ChatGPT, you'll find out it barfs on you. And YouTube will barf on you by simply banning you. But there's a PayPal link in the notes. There's a PayPal link on Spotify while I'm on Spotify. And if you want to donate, you can, but here is the disclaimer. Take care of your food, your water, your shelter. If you can, have a couple, you know, have an extra month's worth of rent money on hand. I'd recommend it. If you've got your own home and it's not an issue, God bless, okay? Take care of those things you need to take care of. And if there are people in your life you need to help, help them first. And if you've set aside some food, make sure you've set aside some food for your pet. But if you've done all these things and you still have, like, I don't know, bazillions of dollars or credits or gold to buy that super cocaine in 30 or 40 years, before the super cocaine arrives, you can donate some of that cocaine money to me. And I'll take the cocaine money and I'll spend it on food, water, shelter, and perhaps some, yeah, beer, and perhaps some other stuff. You know, I'm a human being. I'm lucky to have some donors who are really generous. And I wish I could tell them, you don't need to donate any more than that first time you did. The first time you did was really generous and more than should be required. But the fact is, I don't know how many people actually hear my voice. I can't really trust the data. on any of the sites I post my podcast to. And I honestly can't trust a lot of the data that we get vis-a-vis the internet at this point. I think it's mostly pretty much controlled for whatever purpose. You know, you can have a theory, I can have a theory, but one thing I think a lot of us can agree on is that the World Wide Web is owned. It's controlled. It's not a free exchange of information. It was never going to be that. It began as a military project, and it ends as a military project. What about the dark web, Dan? I will tell you, the dark web is a mirage, but whatever. You know, it's like crypto. You can tell me how private it is, and then we can talk about the blockchain and how every transaction is permanent, and you have unique public keys that you can readily assign to IP addresses, credit cards, social security numbers. And since the know your customer crap has infected crypto, pretty much all your demographic data. And so, yeah, it's not private. It's permanent and it's public, and people will know what you bought. So I'm not going to accept any spin stories about the dark web or going crypto. You're on the Death Star. The only escape from the Death Star is in the name. Okay? The Death Star itself can die, or you can die. That's how you escape the Death Star. I think pretty soon the Death Star is going to crash into the planet, so to speak, in that proverbial or not so literal sense, but I think it's over. The question is that the worst of it? Is the crashing of the Death Star the worst thing? Anywho, if you have extra money for super cocaine or super hookers and you want to donate that super money to Super Dan, you can. There's a PayPal link. You can donate as much as you want to. I'll take it. If you're some Texas billionaire who has a couple single-action pistoles you shoot up in the air every time you hear me say something crazy, even though you think I'm full of shit, you can send me a Texas million if you want to. It's Monday, 3:35 a.m. here in Scompton, Utah. It's still the morning time, and all the little creatures are still asleep. It's still the morning time, and all of the Heflin folk that have wandered the wastelands are now moving to the Bronx. And you can be all creepazoid about the Sector 9 weirdos, but remember, they're the ones that deliver the pizza. It's Monday, June the 5th. 2023. Have a great rest of your day.